This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
We're in the centenary of the First World War this year, and the focus, quite rightly, is on the troops, on the average soldiers. But when we think about their leaders, the generals who commanded them and ordered them into battle, well, then the feeling isn't so good. Too many Australians died because of bad decisions, incompetence, and boneheaded theories about wars of attrition. But there was one undeniably great commander on the Western Front, and he was an Australian, a Jewish Australian, the son of a Prussian migrant. General John Monash was the first commander to properly grasp the implications of the tank and the airplane, and to combine them with infantry and artillery to act in concert, like an orchestra. Tim Fisher calls him Maestro John Monash for that reason. Tim is, of course, a former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, and he's a big fan of John Monash, and the reason is that Monash directed all the energy of his powerful mind to win quickly and decisively, and to avoid the drawn-out agony of trench warfare. John Monash was honoured after his return. There's a university named after him and a freeway too. But for all that, Monash was never made a field marshal, the highest rank in the Australian Army. And the story of his achievements was somewhat smothered. Tim Fisher suspects, well, he knows really, that there was some nasty anti-Semitism at work there back in the day. And he thinks Monash is long overdue for a posthumous promotion. He was, after all, the most gifted general this country ever produced. Tim Fisher's book is called Maestro John Monash, Australia's Greatest Citizen General. Welcome back, Tim.
Greetings, Richard.
Tim, you're a veteran. Was it during your time in the army that you were introduced to the story of John Monash?
A little bit. It was a very truncated second lieutenant officer training course, but picked up a little bit there, more so when Jewellery came into my state electorate and my federal electorate. And of course, Monash grew up in Jewellery for a number of key years. Monash was born in Melbourne, son of Lewis and Bertha Monash, M-O-N-A-S-C-H, in 1865, but then moved to the Riverina, to Jewellery. And there's a great story which Roland Perry and I and Laurie Henry of Jewellery agree did happen. John Monash met Ned Kelly.
Now, how would he have done that, Tim?
Because Ned was casing the joint. He had trouble with the ATM of the era, you could say, and Ned took some direct action on the bank to get his money out or get someone's money out. But the story goes that Ned asked John Monash to hold his horse for a period and subsequently gave him a florin. The dates are such that it wasn't during the bank raid visit of Ned Kelly, but the year before. John Monash's father ran a horse trading business, and they probably met because during the actual major bank raid week, Monash had gone back to school at Scotch College.
Now, as you say, his father was a Prussian Jewish migrant. What brought him to Australia in the first place?
The gold rush, and came all the way out, had a look around, arrived in 1853, and then very bravely returned to Germany, to Posen, on the Polish-German border, to find a wife, to say goodbye to his family, and come back to Melbourne. And their first child was born with the arrival of John Monash in 1865. And already that child hit his straps. I mean, in Jewellery, of all places, he was learning Hebrew, German, French, English, mathematics. William Elliot, his famous school principal, wrote, "I can teach this lad no more. He must go to Melbourne." Went on to become Ducks of Scotch College in 1881.
And he went to Melbourne Uni. And how did he do at Melbourne Uni? What kind of
bounced around a bit. He'd learned a few bushcraft skills. He'd learned how to pace himself, but had a few distractions. So he eventually took a while to graduate in law, arts, and very importantly, he graduated in engineering. And that brought this holistic thinking, this practical dimension as to how you tackle problems, as he took up a first job on the magnificent Princes Bridge in Swanston Street, Melbourne, the Anderson Street Bridge further upstream, the great reading room dome of the Melbourne State Library in Swanston Street at the other end. He left very quickly a massive footprint because he was the master of reinforced concrete. But at all times, he was a reservist. He never went to Duntroon. He never went to Sandhurst. And in a funny sense, when he eventually went to war, this was what was resented about him, that he was still building bridges in Bendigo and Benalla and beyond in Adelaide, and he did all that as late as 1914, and by 1918 he was showing people and showing the British generals how to shorten the war, how to protect your men.
So do you think in that sense, given that he was an engineer, he was always dealing with cutting-edge technology? He was very much a man of the new 20th century rather than the cavalry teakheads of the 19th century that were elsewhere in the British Army.
And he did not go to the Boer War, and he's often accused of having stepped back from doing the right thing by not serving his country in the Boer War, but he had a young baby in Burfa. He had the economic collapse in Melbourne in the early 1890s when the banks closed their doors, a retrenchment from the Victorian Ports Authority, and was setting up his new business. And for a range of reasons, he chose not to go and fight, but there was no doubt on which side he was on. He actually made a private visit with his family when things got a bit better in 1910 to Rome, to Berlin, to England, and back through USA. And the two takeouts from that, from his notes, because he was a great note keeper, was, watch out, the drumbeats of war are starting to unfold, and I did not like the militaristic attitudes in Germany, and watch out, the giant economy of the world's going to be the USA.
He married a woman called Hannah Victoria Moss in 1891, but he did have several affairs. Did that make him the subject of gossip around Melbourne society, Tim?
A little, and more so after the war when he had another mistress that came back from London after his wife, only wife, died. And Bertha, by then a very strong-minded teenager in early 20s and self-married, vetoed her father marrying Liz Bentwich. But he had a bit of a cheek about him because he in fact sent a telegram to his first mistress, Annie, whose husband had taken Annie and family back up to Sydney to get away from John Monash, and said, I'll be arriving on the Melbourne Limited at Sydney Central tomorrow morning on the first day of our honeymoon. Would like to say hello.
He wanted to see his old mistress on the first day of his honeymoon?
Sent her a telegram. What was he thinking?
What was it that forced him to choose between business and the army?
The drumbeat of war. Once a world war unfolded in that dreadful mid-year of 1914, he was by that stage a colonel. He accepted the responsibilities. It was all hands on deck. He was initially appointed head of the Intelligence Corps and then head of the censorship arrangements. He directed all Australian Germans had to cut off their contacts with their families back in Posen, back in Prussia, back in Germany. And then very quickly, a little later on, he was made 4th Brigade Commander, and on the 22nd of December 1914 sailed as the head of the 2nd AIF convoy to war.
So he entered the army full-time as a colonel, and you can see why there were suspicions about his Germanness to some degree, because the picture you've got on the cover of your book, Tim, he looks like Hindenburg, doesn't he? He looks like a classic Prussian general. He's got a bristling moustache, close-cropped hair, a kind of a stern look on his face and all of that.
We erected at Hamel a photo of Monash in an outdoor feature and memorial, and in the fierce winter of France, it quickly degraded. And worse still, it degraded in a way which made him look more like Adolf Hitler than John Monash. It had to be taken down. So the unluck of it all. But yes, he bit by bit got to Colombo on that second AIF convoy. They were in fierce training around Menai and the pyramids with the other divisions and getting ready for whether the order was to go direct to France or, in fact, to the Dardanelles. And because of the initiative of Churchill and Herbert Horatio Kitchener, it was to be the Dardanelles, but a very clumsy arrival at the Dardanelles where they'd virtually told the enemy what they were about to do.
So he arrives there as a brigade commander at Gallipoli. How does he fare there, Tim?
Not good. He made mistakes, but he was up front. He led his troops, captured two Turkish prisoners just near his own bunker.
Oh, he went actually into battle with his own pistol then.
He did, and furthermore, he negotiated a delicate truce on the 24th of May when some white flags had appeared and shouts for a doctor, and a full day's truce took place, and they all went out on top, and they buried the bodies. The Turks buried the bodies, the Allies buried their bodies, there was a bit of exchange of tobacco and things, and 5 p.m. the whistle blew, they all went back to their trenches, and the battle resumed. Let me just read this. He was not a fighting commander, says Bean. Monash's qualities were of a different order, but in the particular crisis of Gallipoli, he ultimately decided to take personal control, and since one staff officer after another sent to the head of a column had failed to return in August, he went forward to ascertain the reasons for the delay of the famous left hook. Arguably, Monash got overwhelmed in that particular tactic, and there's some reports that he lost his mental balance. If he did so, it was only very briefly because he was back on deck. He did not falter. He never took a day's sick leave for the whole war.
What people saw there was just so awful, Tim, just so completely dreadful. And I didn't think anyone had fully understood the implications of modern warfare at the time. Do you think it's possible that he had a breakdown of a kind?
For 1 hour at the particular dawn where things had gone totally wrong the night before, maybe he did. He said, "I thought I could command men," was one statement that a British colonel wrote down, but he said at the time. But he still knew he still had to perform. He had to get them out of this particular ditch and problem, and carried on, and he carried right through to the last day of evacuation from Gallipoli. But he learnt from his mistakes. The first of these was that Australians did things differently. They took their orders down and discussed them with company commanders, even if you were a brigadier. Secondly, began to realise that you needed a holistic approach if you were going to make a big difference. A holistic approach where you used every piece of armoury, every piece of supporting arm that you could to protect your men to the last minute, not just blow a whistle and send 1,000 in perfect alignment up over the trench to be mowed down by the Turk and German machine guns. And thirdly, he began to balance the fact that he could in fact go on leave. He went on leave to Cairo for a week, but he went back into those trenches at Gallipoli. And I often thought when I went on R&R from Vietnam, the strain of knowing what you were going back to, but he certainly was able to really develop his balance and equilibrium to go back and to provide the leadership which saw him as one of the last soldiers to depart after Kitchener had ordered the withdrawal.
He was sent to the Western Front in France in 1916. Did he participate in any of those terrible meat grinder battles in France at that time, Tim?
The Battle of the Somme, the night of the 1st of July, 20,000 Allies under Rawlinson had lost their lives in that morning, that dreadful morning. And I quote in the book Sergeant Yates that said it all, "Almost imperceptibly, the first day merged with the second, when we held grimly to a battered trench and watched each other grow old under the day-long storm of shelling. For hours, sweating, praying, swearing, we worked on the heaps of chalk and the mangled bodies. The next dawn, I looked out and saw some flowers amongst the ferns. And my thought was, how could there still be flowers in the world?"
Do we know what Monash thought of witnessing and participating in those campaigns like Passchendaele and the Somme? Do you think that was there, again, he learned the lessons about the futility of that war of attrition approach where the last person standing, if he's British, then the war is won?
Especially Passchendaele, where there'd been 72 hours of rain and Haig ordered them back up to the line and to mount a battle in circumstances which just saw half a battalion after half a battalion wiped out in the course of that second, third Battle of Ypres and Passchendaele. And again, through that stubbornness, through that failure to listen and consult with people up front in the mud, many more Allies were killed for not one acre of gain.
Monash was made the commander at the Battle of Hamel, and he went in with a comprehensive plan. He allowed for 90 minutes, if all went well. How did it go, Tim?
It was a brilliant, holistic battle. The first time that Monash had actually led the AIF convoy, commanding the five divisions, devising things like leapfrogging, embedding the tanks, support.
Yeah, let's go through this process of this holistic approach. The planes go first, then the artillery barrage, and then the tanks after that.
Embedded with the men.
And the tanks push forward. They clear the way through the wire, the barbed wire, and the men go through. This allowed him to achieve dramatically faster success in battle, didn't it?
And less casualties. And by this stage, under Churchill's role as Minister of Munitions, it was a much better tank, as you might know. He embedded the tanks with each platoon 2 weeks before the Battle of Hamel, so the crews knew each other, knew the right hand signals to give, not run over dead bodies or half-dead injured troops, and carry forward the heavy munitions for resupply and just push them off the top of the tank when they got further forward. And so it was all part of that holistic template that made the difference.
So 93 minutes, again, 2 kilometres of territory, 1,500 prisoners captured, the Germans routed from their position. It was a dramatic success. How much attention did this attract, all this success?
Not enough. Sydney Morning Herald 2 days later, British victory at Hamel. Because
British victory.
All the communications had to go back through Haig's headquarters. There were 7,000 Australians at Hamel. There were 1,000 Americans. If it should have been anything, it should have been Australian and American victory.
Why was this written, Tim? The national press, you'd think, having every incentive to want to write about a great Australian victory from a brilliant Australian commander leading outstanding Australian troops. Why are they writing about a British victory in Hamel?
Partly because Bean was not very keen to highlight the breakthroughs of Monash.
Now, this is C.E.W. Bean, the official war correspondent for Australia. Why was Bean so set against praising Monash for his undoubted achievements here?
Because they fell out at Gallipoli. They had an argument at Gallipoli. Monash complained that he didn't think the 4th Brigade was getting a fair enough coverage, and he was sensitive to that sort of thing. And on top of that, the sanitizers up through the headquarters of Rawlinson and Haig were not all that keen to highlight what the Australians had achieved, and the Americans, in this case of Hamel. And the rest is history. There was a famous little twist out of it, though. The day after Hamel, an American GI was interviewing a German POW and said, "Do you guys still think you're winning the war?" And the German replied, "Yes, God is with us." The American replied, "That's nothing. The Australians are with us."
That's a great story. C.E.W. Bean wrote in his diary, Tim, and I'm quoting him here, "We do not want Australia represented by men mainly because of their ability, natural and inborn, in Jews, to push themselves." Is the reason why Bean is writing down Monash's achievements because he thinks he's an uppity, pushy Jew? Was there a streak of anti-Semitism here in the suppression of the full achievement of John Monash with Australian troops?
Yes, it was. And it was not only Bean, it was Rawlinson himself, who in 1920 wrote some very bad words in respect of a guy called Montagu and Monash, and said they're like a clever, slippery, creepy, crawly Jew.
C.E.W. Bean was trying to construct the myth of the Australian Anzac, this tall, strong, son of the land. Monash didn't quite fit in that picture, even though he was from the country, even though he was brilliant, even though he was an outstanding intellect. Nonetheless, the fact that he was Jewish, perhaps in Bean's mind, didn't fit into this kind of Anglo-Saxon male that he was trying to make the image of the Gallipoli warrior.
And I don't take away from Bean's magnificent 12-volume history of World War One. On the one hand. On the other hand, there are errors in it, and there are errors of judgment in it. And yeah, I mean, Bean would much prefer a Thomas Glasgow, the great Queenslander and commander of the 1st Division. Tall, thin, absolutely wiry as they go into battle and the like. But to come back to your fundamental assertion, was anti-Semitism part of the downplaying of John Monash during and after World War One? Yes, it was, but not perhaps. That wasn't what motivated W.M. Hughes. He was just simply jealous of Monash after the war. It was certainly what motivated, by degrees, people like Rawlinson and C.E.W. Bean.
How about Keith Murdoch, who was the other great war correspondent, father of Rupert Murdoch? He also wanted to downplay Monash's achievements. Was there anti-Semitism there too, Tim?
Well, I went to Rupert Murdoch a couple of years ago, and in 48 hours back he came and he said, "Yes, my father used to speak about Gallipoli a lot." His assessment of John Monash, which had started off very negative, moderated considerably, Rupert's words.
Hamel was a dress rehearsal for the Battle of Amiens, with Monash commanding Australian troops at the centre of that, and it was a smashing success once again. Destroyed German morale. General Ludendorff said it was the blackest day of the war. And so Monash was knighted in the field by King George. There is footage, and it's fascinating to look at. There's no sound to it, but I've seen it, and Monash looks oddly awkward, actually. He sort of gets it over and done with very quickly, and the king taps him on the shoulders, and it's all over and done with. There seems to be an unusual kind of modesty there.
And even Monash can overreact and call on the men for 3 cheers for the king as he was departing, and a few muffled grunts, because the diggers had sort of been pulled off a day's rest after the big operation and asked to line up in front of a chateau and be on a guard. And Australian diggers didn't like that sort of stuff a great deal.
Nonetheless, how did his soldiers feel about him?
In awe. Many wrote in their diaries magnificently about John Monash, and eventually in 1924 they put on a dinner for him, because no one had done anything for John Monash post-war, mainly because of Billy Hughes and keeping him at Lieutenant General. But Albert Jacka, VC, Mayor of St Kilda, put on a famous dinner in the Town Hall of Melbourne, and a digger really got a standing ovation for Monash when he stood up and said, "Look, say everything that you have. Drake Brockman spoke, others spoke brilliantly of Monash at that particular banquet." There's just two words that really the men of the AIF believed of you, John Monash, and that was simply you were always fair dinkum.
Monash planned the successful Allied attack on the Hindenburg line, and that was a great success, and the war with that was essentially over, Tim. He seems to have been better appreciated, despite Rawlinson's remarks, by the British than by Australian leaders.
A bit of both, but essentially the firing stopped on both sides at 11 a.m. Monash was called back to London by Billy Hughes and told to stay in London another year, and that's where the fallout began to develop between W.M. Hughes, Prime Minister of Australia, and our victorious Lieutenant General, John Monash.
A key moment in that seems to have been this special victory banquet at Buckingham Palace that Monash was invited to attend, along with Prime Minister Billy Hughes. Tell me a bit about this spectacular gala evening, Tim.
Everybody who was anybody was there. Woodrow Wilson was there. Five prime ministers were there. Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Mayor of London. We know from Monash's handwritten notes he was sitting next to Rudyard Kipling, an opposite sergeant, and near Churchill. Sparkling end of a great long table.
As you say, that would have been an amazingly sparkling conversation, but it sounds like Monash dominated the conversation even in the presence of those colourful characters, Tim.
Well, he gave and spoke about Ned Kelly of Jewellery, actually, and meeting him exactly 41 years earlier.
Prime Minister Billy Hughes was there as well. Did he feel jealous by the attention that the charismatic John Monash was getting?
Hughes was on a second wing of a table. He was technically slightly closer to the King than Monash because that reflected seniority. But he was stuck next to Austen Chamberlain. He was next to an elderly grouping. And he had his back to three quarters of the audience because of the nature of the particular U sitting, whereas Monash could survey the whole room, had a terrific seat, and allegedly the King at one stage walked past Billy Hughes to shake hands with John Monash because he knew him quite well. They both spoke high German, but not too often and not too loudly, and in the process accidentally stubbed the Prime Minister. Well, that could have been yet another turning point in the jealous attitude that Hughes developed to this shining general with medals and white tie and tails, whereas Billy Hughes was never a knight of the realm. Billy Hughes was a diminutive Welsh Prime Minister, and he couldn't even claim to be the only famous Welsh Prime Minister in the room because, in fact, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister of the era, was dominating the evening at the other end of the table.
Was Hughes worried that Monash might enter politics?
Yes, and become Prime Minister at the next elections due in 1919. So Hughes went to Versailles, did very well for Australia at Versailles, stood up Woodrow Wilson, who challenged him. Who do you represent? I represent the blood of 60,000 Australians, Mr. President. And for half the war, you weren't even here. And to head off Monash, he appointed him Director of Demobilisation and Repatriation in London, kept him jammed at Lieutenant General. It would have helped if he'd been made a full general. Monash, of course, brilliantly organised the ships, 1,000 at a time. It was all typical holistic approach by John Monash. Hughes came back, travelled by train from Perth, right across Australia, welcomed by huge crowds, spoke for 2.5 hours in the House of Representatives, did not mention John Monash once by name in that speech reporting back to Parliament post-war and post the Versailles Peace Conference, but then went to the elections and had a big win.
Never mentioned Monash once in his speech to Parliament. So back in civilian life after the war, the semi-fascist organisation, the New Guard, contacted him.
The New Guard were getting very active in the Great Depression. They said, you are the one man, if you send a word at 12 noon in front of every post office across the land, the AIF will fall in for you, as they did during the police strike, and you sorted that out. You must do this. You must become our Franco, our Mussolini. You must abolish the state and federal parliaments and get this country out of a Great Depression for 10 years, and then we can go back to democracy.
They wanted him to lead a coup d'etat?
Indeed, they did.
And what did Monash say when they asked him to do such a thing?
It was a pretty formal approach from the Grimwade family, and he wrote back a famous letter and said, no, that would be an act of tyranny, that would be an act of treachery. And then this statement that kept me going during some dark days of federal parliament, the only hope for Australia, the best hope for Australia, is the ballot box and a good education.
We've only ever had two field marshals, Australian field marshals, Thomas Blamey from the Second World War and Prince Philip. What's going on? Isn't it time we had a posthumous promotion?
Well, there's
precedent. John Monash.
The Yanks did George Washington in 1976, and George Washington had been dead 176 years by then when he was promoted from 4-star to 5-star General of the Armies. many people would hesitate to do posthumous VCs or acts of valour, George Cross, but they do occasionally a matter of rank. And my argument is that, in fact, people should step up and write to their local federal member or their senator and say, look, we really do owe this guy, as a salute to every member of the AIF 100 years on, and as a salute to John Monash, we should posthumously promote him Field Marshal and backdate it to the 11th day of the 11th month of 1930, 1 year after he became a general. The only thing I would ask is that it not be imposed by Canberra until such time as there's a better understanding of John Monash, and then we go all out in that 2018 year to salute absolutely John Monash of Jewellery, of Melbourne, of Hamol, of Amiens, of Monson Quinton, of the Hindenburg Line by that posthumous promotion.
Great to speak with you once again, Tim. Thank you so much for telling the story of this great Australian.
Thank you indeed, Richard, for the privilege, and it was a joy to put together Maestro John Monash.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.